You're tuned in to People's Tribune Radio. I'm Kenny Shook.
But you know, I'm saving up to buy that neat little SUV for my family once we save up enough and get a little bit out of debt. Why, I even pay as much as I can on my rent. Can't pay it all, though. Got to save a little bit and pay a few parts on my lights and gas, else they'll turn them off.
People's Tribune Radio is brought to you by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also publishes the newspaper People's Tribune, Tribunal del Pueblo. Ordering and contact information will be provided at the end of this show. Today, we hear from PTR correspondents Tony Zaragoza and Jesu Estrada. They interview University of Texas adjunct professor Zainab Tufci. Tufci teaches on the topics of society and technology, and is author of the Washington Post article titled, "They Can Point and Click, But Still End Up Painting Walls." This article takes a critical look at the results of job training for the homeless and the unemployed. We begin today's show with Tony Zaragoza asking Zainab Tufci about the Bush administration's Job for the 21st Century initiative.
Well, could you just start by telling us a little bit about what President Bush has proposed with this Jobs for the 21st Century initiative?
Sure. He proposed about $250 million for jobs training programs that will be mainly administered through community colleges. And at the same time, unfortunately, other vocational training cuts have been put in the budget. So it's a bit of shifting of money rather than new money. But fundamentally, it's $250 million of job training in community colleges.
And what exactly will that do for folks, or what is the intended outcome of these job training programs?
Well, the intended outcome is to get people who are low-income, low-skilled, unemployed, in transition, and to get them to be placed in jobs. The unfortunate part of it is, I mean, there are two sides of the equation, right? People can be trained, but there have to be jobs out there that are waiting for them when they graduate from these training programs. And my research shows me, and the statistics in the job market show me, the problem is that there just aren't enough good jobs out there. So in the programs I studied, very similar to the ones being proposed, people would go through this training with a lot of enthusiasm, dedication, and a lot of effort, because these are hardworking, poor people, so it takes a lot of sacrifice for them to go through this, but were unable to find jobs. There's just, they would try and try and try, and they would end up back at very low wage, no benefit, long hours kind of jobs. It's a big problem.
Well, Zainab, what's happened to these high-tech jobs? Who's working them now?
Well, let me say that the job market is not a single job market. There are two big job markets out there. One of them is for, you know, it's a polarized job market. At the bottom, which is a very large bottom, maybe 50-60%, there never were high-tech jobs. There were service jobs, and there are jobs at Walmart, and there are jobs at fast food restaurants, and so those jobs were never high-tech or high-pay, and they remain that way. On the other hand, there have been a smaller percent of jobs that were well-paid and, you know, sort of better benefits and better kinds of jobs. But those jobs very often require, like, a master's degree, so it's not really within reach of the average unemployed person. Two, those jobs are limited in number. So if everybody got out and said, I'm going to graduate from a tough college and then I'm going to do a graduate degree, there still would be too few of those jobs. And, of course, we're seeing with outsourcing of those jobs, they are now moving to other countries where the employees feel like they can get workers for cheaper.
Yeah, that's one thing that my students are starting to recognize, that the very reality of the globalized economy and how it's affecting domestic labor. I was wondering if you can maybe talk about how race, class, and gender affects not only access to jobs, but also access to technology.
Globalization or?
Race, class, and gender, globalization.
Race, class, right. Well, I mean, we find that a lot of these job training programs, it's more and more training women because we find that what are called pink-collar jobs, there are a lot of clerical jobs out there that are performed. They're sort of gendered as female jobs. They're secretarial, clerical. And they pay very little. And they use tools of high tech like computers, but they don't do anything high skill with them. They just, you know, type letters, pick up the phone, things like that for a very low kind of pay. We also find racially that, like, for example, in Austin, Austin is a high-tech mecca. Austin has got very important high-tech companies like Dell to IBM to Motorola to Samsung, but also is also a very, very segregated city. It has been segregated from the beginning, and there have been efforts to keep it segregated by denying housing, by denying services. So, but by design, Austin ended up with a segregated housing situation and segregated schools. And jobs are segregated, too. In the 10-year boom in the 1990s, or maybe 8-year boom, during which everybody saw in Austin their incomes rise as a result of sort of the internet bubble, in black areas in East Austin, incomes actually fell. So even during the good times, racially, the segregated parts of the town, they just don't get better. When the times are worse, they're much worse. When they're better, they're not better. There's clearly something wrong here.
Well, I mean, that brings me to this current issue of the jobless recovery. And why is it happening?
Well, what's happening is, you see, you can organize the economy around a number of objectives. You can say, we're going to make the most profit available, right? Or you can say, we're going to provide decent jobs to people. Or you can say, we're going to protect the environment. And there's a contradiction between making the most profit possible at any cost and giving people decent jobs. What happens is employees are cutting jobs whenever they can and replacing it with machinery, because unlike people, machinery doesn't complain, doesn't need to get paid, doesn't have overtime or, you know, benefit-related demands, and is easier to boss around because it's a machine. So whenever they can, they're replacing human beings with machines. On the other hand, whenever they can, they're also replacing cheaper human beings with more expensive human beings. So that's why they choose, you know, illegal immigrants who are at a precarious and vulnerable situation because they're trying to make a living, but they're not legal, therefore they can't complain. When that's not enough, when that's not cheap enough, then they go to Mexico. When that's not cheap enough, they go to China. What has happened is productivity in the U.S. economy has been growing. Productivity is amount of output per worker. So each worker has been producing more. There are many ways this can be done. Each work, they could be working longer hours because they're afraid. They could be working harder and more intense because of job insecurity. They might be working with better machinery. So when you have productivity, you have this benefit because you're now producing more. Instead of taking that benefit and saying, let's create more jobs with this benefit, companies have been taking it as a profit to themselves. So as productivity increases, and since profit is the priority of the way this economy is organized, jobs disappear as they're replaced with machines and people do more with less.
You're tuned in to People's Tribune Radio. Writer and adjunct professor at the University of Texas, Zeynep Tucci, is speaking about the labor of workers within prisons with PTR correspondents Tony Zaragoza and Jesus Estrada.
Well, I know another vulnerable population that is used to do work more and more is that of prison labor. And I'm wondering if you could talk, how does prison labor factor into this?
It's amazing. Prison labor is the dream employee for employers. It's literally a captive population. In prisons, people's privileges, phone, you know, recreation, exercise, everything is tied to their good behavior, which is defined as working hard. And they get paid, you know, I don't know, a very, very small amount. And they have nothing to relieve the boredom. They're very motivated to work because they have nothing else to do. And this is the only way they get access to any kind of privilege in a prison situation. So more and more companies, they've been moving call centers to prison, so a prisoner picks up and, you know, makes your airline reservation. They have been removing small production jobs to prison, and it's touted as sort of reforming the prisoners, but it seems like it seems also to provide employees with a semi-slave population, a population that can't go anywhere and isn't paid.
Well, then what happens to these prisoners if, you know, they are released from prison? Are these manufacturing jobs actually going to help them get a job outside of prison?
No, unfortunately. That's a major, major issue because of, mostly because of draconian drug laws and because of a variety of factors. There's a huge number of people in prison. U.S. pretty much leads the developed world in terms of percentage of people in prison. But when they get out, there are many restrictions on what kind of jobs they get, what kind of housing they get. There are many housing, public housing projects won't take them. Many places will not employ them. So while in prison, they're allowed to work for almost nothing as a semi-slave population. But once outside, they're not hireable, which of course creates problems and creates, it often leads to more crime since, you know, they can't start their lives over.
And, well, I just wanted to let the folks here in the state of Washington know that they can see one of these programs if they're ever going through Yakima or if they're from Yakima. There's, you know, the jail is right downtown in Yakima, and there's a part of it right next to the jail or you know, right in the building called the Work Ethic Detention Center. And it says this big, it says putting jails to work. And we've had various states in the Northwest who will make the argument that we don't really need to export jobs to other countries when we have people right here in the state of Washington or the state of Oregon who will work for cheaper. And could you talk about what that dynamic does when you tie profitability to a captive population? What are some of the dangers of that?
Well, for one, there's a big incentive, you know, socially to keep many people in prison, because if it becomes the bedrock of your economy, you really don't want to start, you know, rehabilitating huge numbers of them, because if they leave and don't come back, you will not be able to make a lot of money. The second thing is this is against human dignity. It is against human dignity to force a captive population in this manner. The third problem is for people outside who are not in prison. I would like to ask, how are you going to compete with a prisoner? You cannot, because he or she gets paid a pittance and is a captive. So what will happen is the wages of everybody outside will go down, because if they are providing, I mean, your workplace will turn into prison as prisons turn into workplaces, because that will be the standard by which corporations make profits. It's a very scary thought. I'm not against prisoners being given the opportunity to be productive, as long as it's done in a dignified way, tied to rehabilitation efforts and a job once they're released.
Well, another thing that President Bush talked about in his State of the Union address was a kind of prisoner reentry program. And I'm wondering if you could talk about that. What is that all about, and what does that mean?
The details haven't totally come out yet. I mean, it's one of those things that looks good on paper. It is a big need that there should be a prisoner rehabilitation program. So I think if implemented, that would be a good idea. But that would be a small bucket in the problem. I mean, we have to stop sending huge numbers of people to prison, especially for nonviolent crimes and nonviolent drug-related crimes. Because once a person is in the criminal system, as it is, they have very few hopes of ever getting out of that cycle. So trying to rehabilitate a few and that's coming out. Yes, we owe these people an attempt to rehabilitate and give them a second chance at life. So we should do that. But we should first stop creating more, you know, prisoners to be rehabilitated.
Well, I think one of the important things is to create the conditions so people don't commit crimes, so they have to go to prison because, you know, they can't have their necessities met or, you know, whatever reason that's causing them to go in there. Zainab, I was wondering if you could maybe offer our listeners how you would restructure the market to provide meaningful jobs for people.
Well, I mean, first thing is there is no law that says profit has to come before everything. You know, it's no reason that we can't structure the economy. We can't say you must provide a certain number of jobs. For example, in a case in Austin, Samsung, one of the big semi-tech manufacturers, was going to come to Austin and ask for billions of dollars worth of tax abatements, billions, huge amounts of money. And the city was willing to do that because they reasoned, okay, it's going to create jobs. It turns out Samsung only wanted to create jobs paying $5.50 an hour. So they wanted $1 billion in subsidies in return for McDonald's jobs in their factory. Now, in that particular case, an interfaith coalition got wind of this and forced Samsung to increase it to $7.50 an hour, which is not a great number. But you see, one thing we could do is we could tie corporations' right to act as corporations, to sell, to manufacture, to a number of jobs they create and the quality of those jobs. I mean, there is no, it is not one of the Ten Commandments that you will only live for profit. We have a constitution, we have laws, and we can say in those laws, perfectly legal, a company has to provide a decent living wage. We could increase the minimum wage. We could provide more health care. We could tie any subsidies these corporations get to direct benefits to their employers. Even those little steps, I mean, yes, they're big steps, but they're not, you know, they don't require a total major restructuring of the economy. If the Congress wanted to wake up tomorrow and do this, it could do this. This is a big economy. It's a very strong economy in its fundamentals, and they could do this in one day. And it would lift millions and millions of people out of poverty, out of low-wage jobs, and profits would maybe go down a bit. But, you know, they're breaking profitability records. They could live with that.
Well, one of the things that they have done is the welfare-to-work program. And could you talk to us about what this welfare-to-work program has done? Because in some ways they're still bragging about how great this is. It's getting people off of welfare and into work. Well, what are the everyday effects that this is having on people's lives?
Well, first of all, it hasn't gotten them off poverty. Majority of people who get off welfare, the welfare-to-work program forces them to take a job at any wage. So all it has done is it's created this huge pool of labor that is cheap and is forced into these jobs. And if people who are off who have never been on welfare, who never expect to be on welfare think this doesn't affect them, they really should. Because once you institutionalize a huge amount of captive workforce, because welfare-to-work people are a form of captive workforce, once you institutionalize such a labor market structure, they will come and compete with your jobs. There's a very good example from a study in New York. A professor in, I think, University of Oregon, Gordon Lafer, did the study. What happens is they pushed their welfare-to-work people into jobs in the park system, so where they would be, basically it was semi-make work, but they would be sweeping the parks and cleaning them up. As a result of this, they fired all their regular employees. They only used these welfare-to-work people, and for these welfare-to-work people, there was no regular job they could graduate into because now everybody was a welfare person. This is the kind of thing that destroys good jobs by creating captive populations.
And has it benefited corporations in how they do business?
Yes, they benefit because there was another example highlighted where in one city, the poultry factory, I don't know if you know about poultry jobs, but they're horrible. You have to move. You have these chickens coming 50, 60 a minute, depending on where you work. You're deboning, skinning. It's incredible. The smell is incredible. The dirtiness and the bacteria and the repetitive, tiring motion. So most people don't want these jobs. They pay very little either. Plus, the level of injuries is incredible because you're working very tired and you have these knives flinging around. So what the welfare office did was, in collusion with the poultry factory, when people applied for welfare, they would say, well, you'll only get welfare if you can't find a job. And people would say, look, I can't find a job. They would direct them to this poultry work. It's the kind of work that people, for obvious reasons, don't want to take. And if enough people were allowed not to take it, maybe they could improve that job. They could slow down the line. They could, you know, let workers take more breaks. They could let workers go to the bathroom more often. They could clean up the place. But since there's this captive population, that corporation now has employees who have no choice but to work there at minimum wage until they're totally burned out and, you know, what's left of them finally quits.
This is People's Tribune Radio. Our guest today wrote an article in the Washington Post titled, "They Can Point and Click But Still End Up Painting Walls." Zeynep Tucci is sharing what people can do to better the conditions of working class America with correspondent Tony Zaragoza.
Well, Zeynep, one of the things that we try to focus on in this show is what we can do, what our listeners can do. Are there things that you know of or that you can think of that the people who are listening to this program can do to begin solving some of these problems that we see before us?
The employers are very much empowered by the latest development. The technology aids them, the political situation aids them, everything is aiding them. So that has to be balanced. The ways to balance these, they could change depending on where you are. But first obvious thing is collective solidarity as employees. You have to bring some power to the bargaining table in the employees because the employers are very powerful. The other thing is to vote for politicians who will raise the minimum wage, who will tax corporations, who will stop their tax evasion schemes, who will have a fair system of taxation. And one thing I want to say is I think a lot of politicians now are sort of taking, oh, it's just going to China, it's going to India, it's the fault of the Chinese or the Indians. And that's total scapegoating. What we have here is greedy corporations. They're just running around the world. If we stopped all outsourcing, there would be many downsides to it, and we would only recover a few years of temporary reprieve before, you know, we were back where we started from. If we said no more jobs are going to go to India or China, it would maybe give us 3 more years, maybe 5 more years. I mean, as long as this greed is not checked, they would beat us back down to where we are now with fewer jobs and less good jobs. So I want to caution against saying, okay, let's just have some laws that prevent outsourcing and let's cling to a few hundred thousand jobs for a few more years. It's not Indian workers versus Chinese workers versus American workers. It really is, it's a little corny, but it really is workers of the world kind of situation against very greedy and very profitable corporations.
I don't see that as corny as at all. But
me neither. Zeynep, on our show, we like to ask a question of vision. And we were wondering if you can maybe offer us your vision for a more humane world, or maybe a world where workers aren't exploited.
I kind of have a wish of how it would not be. One thing would be everybody who was willing and able to work would have a decent life and health care and some security for education and housing for themselves and their families. And work is it can be a very fulfilling and a dignity imparting part of being human. It's something that most adults, this is what we do, we work more than anything else. The amount of time we spend working is more than the amount of time we spend sleeping, eating, being with our families, reading, anything you can think of, you can be sure you're actually working more than that. So if it is structured in a way that imparts dignity and provides a good livelihood, instead of what it is now, which is thank God it's Friday, thank God I don't have to put up with whatever it was I've been putting up with, it could turn into Monday, what am I going to produce? What am I going to contribute with my fellow workers today? And it could be, okay, and now I can go home at a decent hour, and now I can provide my family and my children with some basic needs. That would be wonderful. It's not out of the question. It's these laws that we have, they can be changed. They're not written in stone.
That concludes our interview with University of Texas adjunct professor Zeynep Tucci. However, we do still have a bit more. People's Tribune Television's Marshall Blasovsky and Bruce Jenkins share with us a letter from Willie Floyd. The letter was read by Bruce Jenkins on People's Tribune Television in Long Beach, California.
Hey, look at me. Don't I look like the All-American success story? I don't. Why not? Look, I get up every morning at 4 o'clock just to be there by 8. Yeah, I catch the bus. But you know, I'm saving up to buy that neat little SUV for my family once we save up enough and get a little bit out of debt. Why, I even pay as much as I can on my rent. Can't pay it all, though. got to save a little bit and pay a few parts on my lights and gas, else they'll turn them off. My phone, been off almost a month. That's okay. As soon as I get caught up, I'll try to get it back on. As soon as I finish paying January's bill. You know, I spent my last $100 the other day buying a Mother's Day ring for my mother for Mother's Day. Yeah, so I'm broke now. But I don't worry much about that because I can always borrow a little bit from one of my coworkers to make it through the week. I go to church. Seldom. But you know what? Maybe one day God really will bless America and allow my boss to give me a raise. God knows I need it. I'm not asking for much. But $6.50 an hour. I don't think anyone can live like that anymore. God knows my family and I, we're so tired of eating chicken and rice and beans. After they take out tax and Social Security, I got nothing left. Yeah, I drink. So what? I drink a little bit, and my wife smokes maybe about 3 packs a week. What's wrong with that? What do you mean? I should put that towards something more meaningful, like paying off my debt. Wait, hold on, dude. My boss drinks that way as well. And I mean a lot. His wife drinks and she smokes. But I don't hear anyone telling him about how he should spend his earnings meaningfully. You know? He just laid off Calvin and Lewis the other day. Said he couldn't afford their salary. His stockbroker and his lawyer told him that he should cut some of his savings. And cut he did. You know, Lewis and Calvin were only making about 50 cents more than I was. He even had the nerve to ask me, would I take a pay cut? I say, like hell I would. You know, my little girl got sick the other day, and I had to drive her, she and my wife, to the hospital, the county hospital. I got no medical insurance. My boss said he can't afford it. And you know what? That bastard had the nerve to try to fire me for what I did. You know, you call me crazy if you want to, but I can't understand why just the other day he asked me to go to the casino to pick his wife up and take her ass all the way home. You know where they live? Pacific Palisades. You know where I work? Compton. He didn't want to fire me for that. He even had me go up to his place. Went up there to help him build a fence around his sky deck. Of course, I wasn't paid for that. He just gave me lunch and sent my black ass home. Now, I wonder, how come it's all right for my boss to spend his money the way he wants to do whatever it is that makes him happy? And why me? Why I always got to be scrutinized and ridiculed for wanting to spend my hard-earned money the way I see fit? You know, let me tell you something. Poor people, the working poor, we deserve happiness in this miserable world as well. But you know what? Then again, it's life in the big city, baby. For me, at least. Willie Floyd.
That's it for this edition of People's Tribune Radio. PTR is brought to you by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. If you would like to order a radio program or subscribe to our newspaper, the People's Tribune Tribunal del Pueblo, you may do so by calling 1-800-691-6888. That number once again is 1-800-691-6888. Or visit us on the web to donate, download, or check out our speakers bureau at www.lrna.org. I'm Kenny Shook, and on behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, thanks for listening, and please, join us next time for People's Tribune Radio.